Good morning and welcome to our work session for the comprehensive plan update for alternatives 1, 2, 3, and 4. Oliver, if you want to lead for 1, 2, and 3, we'll get her going.
Good morning, councillors. Good morning, councillors. Oliver Ojako, Community Planning Director. What I will do quickly, there is a handout. It's two pages, both front and back. I will go over that quickly, and then I'll turn it over to the council, Councillor Madour, for discussion. He will lead the discussion on alternative four. What you have is the purpose of today's work session, update on actions we've taken since 2015. Proposed next steps, and then at the back of that you will find what we are calling alternative 3.1, city initiated changes, and I'll provide you where we are. All the cities have responded to our deadline, the second deadline, so I will report on what have changed. So the purpose of today's work session is to planning staff to present alternative 3.1. There will be discussion led by Councillor Madour on discussion of alternative 4. Then I'll be asking for Council's direction on the alternatives, and then see if we can get any direction from the board today. If I may, quickly, we had a work session on January 21st. 2015, at which time the board directed us to pause so that alternative 4 can be developed. There was also a discussion of an item that was put on consent, that's the City of Richfield request to add about 107 additional acres to their UGA. We had our first work session February 18th with a discussion of alternative 4. Following that, we wrote letters to all the cities advising that March 3rd should be the final deadline for the cities to make additional requests to the county to reaffirm their previous position or to ask for additional UGA expansions. So today, March 11th, we are here to present the response back from the cities. If you flip the handout to the second page or the other side, that's a chronology of what have happened up till now. The second handout has two sides. What you will see on the first side is on the legend says alternative 3, October 2014. That is the request as was submitted by the cities in the first deadline we asked for boundary expansion request. You can see that only the cities of Le Centre and Barrow Grand were asking for UGA expansion. And we just put a bubble to show you where those sites are. In the case of Le Centre, it is north of Le Centre Road, about 56 acres or so. And then the city of Barrow Ground, east of the current urban growth boundary, towards Dollar's Corner, for about 80 acres. The response we received from the cities, if you flip to the back side of the handout, you will see that the city of Le Centre is maintaining their request for the job land of about 56 or 52 acres, but they're also requesting that the county add 17 acres currently zoned Rural 5 for a new school site. This request is coming at the request of the La Santa School District. You can see also in a circle for each field, they're asking for 107.5 acres or so, currently zone ag, that it be added in the urban growth boundary for residential. The further to the east, you will see that the city of Washougal is requesting about 40 acres plus, currently zone rural 5, be added to the urban growth boundary for residential. So that's the response that we've received from the cities. I must say that the city of Commerce is not requesting for boundary expansion. Neither is the city of Vancouver. And, of course, the town of Yakult, we have completed their own plan update and comp plan, so they're not requesting any change in their current urban growth boundary. That's the response from the cities that I am calling alternative 3.1. What I can report to the council is that we have not done any analysis on these two areas that Washougal and Richfield are requesting, to be able to estimate how much of that land is usable. And I know that the council have not made any decision in the case of the city of Richfield request. You took public comment on February 3rd, but did not make any decision. You wanted additional information to enable you to make a decision one way or the other, whether that is included in alternative 3 or not. So that concludes my remarks. Following discussion or presentation of alternative 4, I will then get into the proposed next steps and outreach, so that we can restart the SEPA process. You hear me say at this work session that time is of essence, and the sooner we restart the process, I think we will be able to meet our timeline. My local city partners are also expressing concern in terms of the delay. So hopefully we can get a decision or direction from the council that we move this forward. So I'll turn it over to Council Mador. Thank you. Unless you have questions for me.
Tom, I have a question here.
Oliver, early on, and I don't remember if we took care of it in a different fashion, Yakult was looking for an extension for their septic system.
We did that plan for
we
them.
Did that already.
Yes, we did that already, and the council approved that when? 2013.
Early 2013,
yes.
Okay. And then these maps aren't very large. On the center's urban growth boundary, it still borders the I-5 on the east side. Is that correct?
Yes, correct. And the bigger map of that is behind you, in case if you want to see. I apologize, but it is behind you. It is on the east side.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, I assume everyone has the PowerPoint presentation for Alternative 4. We also have the maps coming around, and we also have whoever wants from our citizens extra maps here. Okay, so Jose, we can start with the Alternative 4 presentation. We also have extras here for the citizens. Starting out here, I think it's important that we communicate the purpose, and so we just, there's only 6 slides. It's very simple. It's very easy. So the best way to communicate is just simply to present that. So the while we're handing these out, let me provide a few more maps. We'll take a break while everybody can get a chance to get these. All
Harbor Reserve.
Great. Okay. There are two maps. Okay. We'll give opportunity for everyone to be able to get copies of the handouts. Okay, we can jump into the first slide here. The purpose for Alternative 4 is to provide a more reasonable range of alternatives to be analyzed in SEIS. That analyze is really the process of us getting more input so that we can make a more informed choice. This puts it in the pipeline. It does not commit us to implement that. It basically provides a process of analyzing, and that's the intention of the SEIS. It's also to provide affordable options to better accommodate future growth and environmental stewardship. So those affordable options, if we get this wrong, they end up driving the cost of properties up, either by making them too large or by making them too few. So the idea is to provide sufficient needs, sufficient supply for the future. Update policies to adapt that's the federal farm census, recognizing the trend toward more smaller farming economies on smaller rural parcels. We've got to make sure that we adapt and we don't just simply stay behind as though the world hasn't changed. The world has. Our community has changed. Provide improved economic opportunities in the rural areas. So much of the process up to about a month and a half ago has been focusing on the economic opportunities in the urban areas. And we want to make sure that we do not neglect the rural areas. It's a very important part of our community. Jose, you can flip to the next one. So guiding principles and goals. These are very important. The first one is that this proposal does not de-designate any resource land, not ag, not forest. It corrects fundamental discrepancies between the actual predominant lot sizes and the existing zoning map. So what we have out there is a recognition of the real world, what's already built. There's a huge discrepancy between our zoning and what's really out there. Respect the actual rural character in each local area to provide better compatibility and consistency with adjacent properties. So the rural character is defined by the real world out there. That's important that we, again, recognize reality, what's already there. That forms the real character. 4, add clustering options to better aggregate parcels and preserve resource land and open space, forestry, and agricultural non-residential use. In other words, we want to make sure that we fulfill the intent of the GMA, which is to preserve the resource land. Clustering options puts that aside in large aggregate areas for the future. Allow a wider range of affordable lot choices to fill obvious market gaps and provide a better balance. That's written into the GMA in numerous places, and right now we have few choices. This will correct that. And the last one, add flexibility needed to convert fallow land to more manageable, economically viable agricultural and forest land. That reality of preserving for the future while ignoring the present is a problem that we face today. Much of the land that is zoned like it is, owned like it is, does lie fallow. And it can be so much more productive, both for forest as well as agricultural products. So this allows that to be much more productive and an important part of our local economy. So we have some problems that we've inherited. We don't want to kick the can down the road. We want to be able to actually fix what's broken. And this does not create any new lots. This just recognizes what the problems are out there in order to lay a foundation that matches our reality. 92% of the forest zones are less than 40 acres, but we don't have a forest zone that has a minimum lot size of less than 40. So by our own definition, we make them non-conforming. That's not recognizing reality. We can fix that. And you can see the other stats there for 84% of the FR40s are less than 20. 42% of the FR40 zones are less than 5. So, again, we have a problem to solve that this does not create new lots. This recognizes what's out there. Both ag and R zones have similar numbers. So we can fix this, and we can recognize what's there. That lays the foundation for the path forward. The problem is the perpetual non-conforming status of most lots is caused by out-of-date zoning that does not reflect the predominant lot sizes of the actual environment. So it's not that the lots have developed in non-compliance. The problem is that they were developed and we made them non-compliant by our definition after the fact. The solution is to recognize the obsolete zoning of the past that does not reflect reality and provide smaller zoning options to meet the needs of the future as indicated by the federal census. So once we have the foundation of recognizing what is really out there, then there's a two-step process. That's the first step. That's the having a map that tells us what how our community really is, recognizing that reality, and then the next step then is to ensure that we have consistency between what's out there and what else belongs together so we don't end up with spot zoning when we finally recognize that reality. So there's the two steps to this. The first one is to correct the mismatch between how we have defined the rural lots out there. And the second step is to ensure that built on that foundation, we have an appropriate way to allow consistency in adjacent areas and predominant areas to recognize the opportunity that the adjacent parcels ought to have. Okay, Jose? So these are the options to be analyzed for alternative four. The forest zones include, the idea is for in forest zones to include 10 and 20 acre minimum lot sizes where appropriate. And that's considering the existing rural nature, that's in reality, and the predominant lot sizes. The second one has to do with agricultural zones. Include 5 acre minimum lot sizes because they're already there. And where appropriate, and consider the existing rural nature and predominant lot sizes. The third zone here is the rural zones and include 1, 2.5, and 5 acre minimum lot sizes, size areas where appropriate, and that's considering the already developed lots. Most of the rural lots that are non-conforming have already been built, already developed, and is recognizing them. So each of these have the recognition of what's there and also has to do with the recognition of what's appropriate in that area. And the last one is to add the clustering options to aggregate and preserve 70% of each of those basic zone types, rural, ag, and forest, land into open space for agriculture, forest, or other non-residential uses. Each of these are, they're not unique to Clark County. What it may be unique is the degree of mismatch between what we define on our zoning map and what's really out there. So other counties throughout our state have addressed these, and the smaller zone minimum sizes are available for forest and agriculture and rural lot sizes, and clustering options are available also in elsewhere in the state. So these tools are simply there is good precedence elsewhere. And there is one other area that we need to address, because it's been using the urban holding and urban reserve on a very long-term basis, and it approaches a virtual moratorium in areas that leaves many of our citizens in limbo for many years. So the solution to that would be at least to provide come up with a policy for us to bring that forward, that some rural property owners in current urban reserve and urban holding areas have been frozen for many years with no progress and leaving them in limbo. That's the problem. The solution is to adopt a policy that sets reasonable time frames for review and possible action. We have on the grid, Jose, if you can bring that up, several maps that describe what those problems are. And if you look at the key in the top left corner first, you can zoom a little more so we can find it easier to read. Note that this map is just simply recognizing what's already out there. This map does not propose changing anything except recognizing what's out there. This is step one. This is to recognize for us to correct our zoning so that we don't make those lots non-conforming. We allow them to be conforming because our responsibility is to have realistic zoning that serves the citizens. So the colors there, we have lots that are less than 2 acres, yet they're zoned something significantly larger. Less than 2.5, less than 5, less than 10, yet they're zoned each 10 or 20. And the last color there is less than 20 acres, yet they're zoned with a 20-acre minimum. So if you zoom in, for instance, if you go east of Battleground and zoom in, you'll see what is reality there. Okay, zoom, go down. Okay, right there. Good. Okay. All of those colors there show the degree of non-conforming lots. And they're not non-conforming because people have violated the law. They're non-conforming because we have specified the inappropriate zone for those lots that are already there. So the policy ought to reflect the rule and not be based on exceptions. Certainly there would be a small percentage of those that may be possibly have been created after the zoning was already in place. In other words, you would call them non-conforming just simply because of the sequence. But that is certainly the rare exception. The rule here is that these lots already existed. And I believe it's our responsibility to reflect a realistic zoning map that doesn't make them non-compliant. So that's basically there's one more map we can show. These are on the grid. There you go. Okay. Map 4, Urban Reserve, the bottom one. That one. Okay. So you can slide up a little bit there. And the colored areas of the map show those urban reserves, reserve areas and urban holding areas that have been there. Most of them have been there for many years. So what we have is the problems to address, corrections to make, and these are scroll down so we can see those areas. There we go. Okay. Especially up there in the Discovery Corridor area. We've had numerous citizens appeal to us for relief to get them out of limbo. And it doesn't mean that we're going to take them out right now, but at least it means we have a policy that revisits this and considers a path forward so that they can move on with their lives and we can still align some, make some reasonable plan for the future so that we can provide for the needs of residential as well as business land within our county. Okay, with that, we can, Jose, just back up to the presentation. One more slide. Go to slide five. And that's basically, that's the basic options to be analyzed in alternative four. With that, open it up to questions and dialogue.
Is this on?
Touch it and see. Out is out. Out is talking.
Okay. Well, Clark County Citizens United applauds the county considering an alternative that's different than the status quo. We see the alternatives 1 through 3 as pretty much status quo. And we think it's important that, you recognize the reality. And the other thing is we should be bringing the county in conformance with what most other counties do. Very few other counties in the state, if any, have got this extremely large lot zoning. And there's numerous court cases that show that counties that come up with plans similar to what you're suggesting have prevailed in the courts. So I think you're on solid ground to consider this alternative, and we'd like to thank you for including it.
Sure. I'd like to make a point on that, too. There has been early on a fear that if somehow we recognize reality out there, that we're going to get sued in court because we changed everything. In reality, we're not changing. That foundation doesn't change anything. There is zero environmental impact because it recognizes the foundation. That's step one. Once we know the foundation, once we see that step one foundation and say that's the real map out there, step two will allow us to be able to add consistency and the flexibility and the appropriateness of the adjacent areas, the predominant lot sizes in those areas that will make our map more uniform and consistent so that those adjacent predominant areas will allow the subdivision that would be consistent with that same character that's already there. So there's two levels. And the legal defensibility of this, there is no legal consequence. There is no legal threat whatsoever in us analyzing, putting the reasonable options as we see them according to our discretion to analyze them in the EIS. Because the final outcome is based on the final outcome when we finally make decisions and we finally say this is our plan, now you have something that needs to be able to stand up to legal defensibility. But the process between now and then, as I read the SEIS and as I read the GMA, that EIS is intended to consider reasonable options. And it would be inappropriate for us to eliminate those, short-circuit those, before we even analyze them. Our decisions are only as good as the information it's based on. The EIS process is to provide to us, all of us, the impacts of the potential options that are out there. We do not have enough information at this point to eliminate these reasonable options. Any dialogue or questions?
Well, I'll touch on just one of the things that was mentioned, and I have some concern in the clustering portion of it, and that is the remainder of that parcel of the cluster would remain in perpetuity.
Yes.
And I think I understood from staff that when we when the city's built out to those areas and they come inside the urban growth boundary, that the perpetuity goes away.
Chris can answer that.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay. That was one of my concerns for future down the way. So that does answer that question.
Commissioner Story.
The first thing that I want to ask is of staff. In resource zones, do we permit new residential lot development?
Yes, we do. In the resource designation, Ag 20, Forest 40, and we do permit home sites that meet the minimum lot size. We also do permit building or issue building permit on lots that are not consistent with the current minimum parcel size if they were legally created lots.
If they are legally created lots.
That's true. So those non-conforming lots would have to follow our Title 40 provision to do a legal lot determination. And if they are legal lots, county would issue them a building permit.
So tell me how an illegal lot comes about.
Some of this will be, I will turn over to our legal counsel, but a legal lot will be, for example, you know the history of the county, and some of my colleagues here have worked in the county. There was a time in the early 80s that the county permits under FX 1 acre zoning. And prior to the 1994 comp plan update to be consistent with the Growth Management Act, there were some areas that were zoned for 1 acre, 2.5, and 5. If property owners took advantage of what the zoning was in effect at the time, and those will be considered legal lot that conforms with the county land use zoning. In those instances, we have to do a legal lot determination to make sure that they comply not only with the state platting rules, but also with the local county zoning. So if those parcels are, that's what we would determine that is a legally created lot. Now, as you know, there are business owners, for a variety of reasons, that create parcels for tax purposes. There are families that also create lots for tax purposes. It's not illegal to create a parcel just for tax purposes, but that is different from a legal lot that conforms to the state platting laws and the local zoning tools.
So there could be, on a larger parcel, separation into smaller parcels or lots for the purpose of maybe a family which owns the parcel, the larger parcel, breaking it into smaller parcels for the purposes of getting tax statements. So separate people would be individually responsible for paying the taxes.
That's correct. That could happen, and it's not illegal. They can do it. There's also a minimum if they follow state statute. There's a minimum if you have 40, you can put it into 220s. That will be legal, but they will be taxed differently. Now, if you're coming in, if it's zone 40 and you're coming in to build a home on the 20, we will have to review that to see when that 20 was created or parcel or saved.
I see. So I do have a question for Mr. Madore. It's just a definition that I think the term in the PowerPoint is property that's fallow. I'm trying to find where I read that.
Yes. It's on the bottom. It's number 6 on that on the screen.
Well, at any rate, that the word.
The next page.
The word fallow, in for the purposes of what we're looking at here, would you explain to me? Because
sure.
Fallow can mean a lot of different things. I mean, it, to me, there can be 20 acres that are fallow for a year or two to recover soil in an ag. And whether that would truly be considered fallow or not, there might be property that's logged, timber property, and maybe until that land comes back into some other form or is replanted. So what in your mind, what are you thinking fallow would be?
It really has to do with our history. It used to be that we would have many large farms in Clark County, and many and both for ag and for forest, large areas, and which were large enough for the land owners to live on the property and to make that their full-time income. That was their livelihood. They could live off of the land because they had all of the implementation, all the implements, enough of a harvest to be able to carry them through from year to year. And that has changed over the years so that now we have a very small number of full-time farmers in Clark County. Instead, what we have is many large parcels that are unaffordable to citizens that would otherwise purchase something that would be more manageable, that the landowner typically, most, or should I say the vast majority of landowners in Clark County, if they're working, they work elsewhere. They work a full-time job, and when they come home, their family, their activities, if they want to be able to have a grow any crops, it's a part-time basis. It's the extra time from raising your family, going and taking kids to soccer, something that would be much more manageable. And because we have kept these parcels locked into such large areas, no longer can citizens afford to buy that many acres. And if they do, then they can only manage a small number of those acres, and the rest of it just sits there. And we could feel good about that because we're preserving it for the future, but in reality, it lies fallow. In other words, it's not really growing anything productive, which means it's not contributing to their livelihood. It's not part of our local economy. We've basically taken it out of circulation for some future use, while and somehow at the present preventing it from being productive. So we have a very strong farming community, many citizens in Clark County that care about this rich soil that we have, the potentially productive land that makes up so much of our rural area, and they are unable to have the flexibility to have a manageable size portion or lot to do that. Probably the simplest analogy would be to consider we all would like to only have gardens, and many of us live in areas where we have our own garden, but and our neighbors have theirs. So if we live in a neighborhood where everybody has a garden, it's not likely that we're going to be able to have a full-time job working, earning a living and a livelihood for our family, and maintain and weed everybody's garden in our neighborhood. It's not manageable. But if we have many neighbors in the neighborhood, each one caring for their own garden, their own fruit trees, their own backyard, their own small farm, something in the vicinity of 2.5, 5 acres. Even many of our farmers are, well, they're a variety of sizes that's manageable to them. Then all that property, so much more of the property, instead of lying fallow, which means it's not being cultivated, it's not producing anything that of economic value. It doesn't show up with any produce at the farmers' markets. We can open that door and allow this land to be farmed, you know, because it puts it within the grasp, both price-wise and availability-wise in the market, for individuals to be able to make that choice and say, I want to farm, and I want to, and I can afford that because it's within my grasp.
So I really appreciate that more detailed. What I'm looking at is, if we are going to establish guiding principles and goals, and we use the word fallow is a matter of opinion, and I might think that land I'm not using, you might look at it and think nothing productive is happening there, and that might be my very choice. So in fact, somebody told me that about my hedgerow. So this fallow, we would need to have a very specific definition if we're going to put it into a policy for policies, principles, and goals. Because there will have to be sort of an exacting extraction when we look at code and so on and so forth. And maybe we can come back to the maps. I think we have a couple other.
I have a couple of comments. One on the issue of development on non-conforming lots. We've heard stories that there have been a significant number of people who've been denied permits to build on non-conforming lots, and that conditions are placed on. And the, if the permits do go through, for conditions are put on those permits that wouldn't be put on a conforming lot. Another issue is we strongly support the clustering option. You know, I grew up in North County. I live in a five-house cluster surrounded by trees, and we have our home place is 17 acres. And I think if you I've traveled through New Hampshire and Vermont, and you go through there, and it looks entirely rural. You fly over with an airplane, you see thousands of houses. I mean, you can maintain rural character with a larger population. Clustering is one way to do that, so I applaud you providing that. On the issue of size, very few people want to buy 20 and 40 acre parcels because they have to manage that land. So when you come up with something like fives and tens, that's something a little more manageable. And if you want to do part-time farming, you can do it. Trying to farm 20 or 40 acres when you've got a full-time job is damn near impossible. So those were my comments.
Sure. I'd like to explore a little bit. Oliver, what conditions require a citizen who wants to build a home on their property to obtain a legal lot determination in the rural area?
I will defer to legal, but they have to come in to apply for a building permit, and that will trigger us reviewing. But
in other words, all building permits require every citizen to obtain a legal lot determination?
No, and if the property is located within an existing plat, so that we can determine from the review of the plat itself that the lot has already been reviewed for compliance with 5817, that no legal lot determination is done, but you have to view this in the context of 5817.210 prohibits the county from issuing any development permits for properties divided in violation of platting.
Yes.
So as a starting point, we have to look at the property. We have to look at the property and determine whether it's a legal lot. Now, if the parcel is historic, the county has had since, I've been here a while, the county has had in effect since before 1980, well, in 1980 when we did the 79 comp plan, we had in effect a grandfathering provision in 18411010 that allowed historic parcels that were created either before the platting laws or created before our most recent comp plan to be considered as legal non-conforming lots. That's a term of art, and you need to use it carefully, but if a parcel is a legal non-conforming lot, there is no condition other than compliance with the building code plan or the building mechanical plumbing, the traditional safety codes that every property owner has to comply with. The distinction I think that Mr. Malinowski is speaking about is if a parcel is illegal, if it's been divided illegally because they've either done boundary line adjustments that don't comply with the platting statute or they've broken it up without going through a platting process, they're prohibited from receiving permits. Now, the state law provides some flexibility for local governments in two areas. In the first area, where you're dealing with innocent purchasers, there's an opportunity to provide for building permits and even some requirements. In the second area, there is what's been referred to as a public interest exception, and the county, to discourage people from doing this, has said that where lots have been created in violation of platting, we will look at those and look at what would have been required had it gone through the process legally. And if, for example, they were required to connect a sewer, connect a public water, and it's available, we'll make those as conditions to treat them in the same way they would have been treated had they gone through the process in the proper form. But that's the only circumstance in which a parcel is imposed conditions, and it's because it starts out being illegal.
Okay, and that's where I want to be able to get some definition, because you use the term in violation of platting. And I assume that's in violation of our zoning map.
No, it's in violation of RCW 5817, which is the state law that regulates how property can be divided.
Yes. Okay. Well, the really it has to do with the degree of complexity and cost that would end up being a burden to anyone who wants to be able to build a lot in an existing lot that is already mapped properly. In other words, our zoning map reflects reality out there. The lot was already pre-existing before we don't make it non-compliant because of our definition. One of the intents of this is to simplify, remove, or at least decrease the cost and the complexity and the burden for landowners who own lots that comply with our zoning map. If whatever process they need to go through, we don't want to complicate that for them. We want to make sure that, for instance, if you've got a number of 5-acre lots out there that have been around for ages, and we zone them a 20-acre zone, then the process of them getting a building permit is going to be more difficult, more costly. It may be possible, but the problem is that our legal lot determination process can be simplified, and this would enable us to move in that direction.
It's complicated to answer that, to try and discuss that issue, but you have to understand that we have two obligations. I mean, the people who have done this process correctly, who have complied with platting and created lots and made sure they made appropriate provision for roads and water and stormwater and all these things, are selling lots in the same marketplace as people who have done it illegally. And sometimes the penalties, the having to go through and do it right, is what keeps people doing it correctly. So you want to encourage, first first of all, you want fair competition among the two groups, and second of all, you want them to do it correctly. So there is, these were important things the state legislature thought had to be considered. For properties that were divided illegally, and those, and I'm not talking about legal non-conforming pieces, because as I said, those properties are entitled to building permits without any other consideration other than proving that their buildings meet the building code and that they have an adequate water supply and septic that will perk. But assuming they comply, then those ones get permits. What we're describing here are properties that were divided, and at the time of their division, they never went through a subdivision or short subdivision process. They did it either claiming to be exempt or they did it in direct violation of 5817. Those properties, the legislature had basically said, should be recombined. What our county does is, to some extent, we've gone the extra step to try and make it cheaper for local property owners or for innocent purchasers to be able to still get permits without having to recombine properties. For innocent purchasers, you want to let them realize their dreams.
Sure.
So we can go some distance, but for the properties that are in place currently that don't comply with platting or zoning, we're prohibited from issuing permits for those parcels.
Sure. And, of course, none of this is intended to somehow base our policy on that, those exceptions.
Okay.
The idea is to base our policies upon the rules. The legal non-conforming can be made legal conforming with when we correct our map to reflect the reality that's out there. In other words, it simplifies the process. It doesn't eliminate the process, but it ensures that we don't somehow make something, a process, more costly or more burdensome. That's the end. The idea is to make sure that we do our role here, that we recognize what's appropriate out there, and we don't have some kind of an agenda that says we really wish that there were 40 and 80 and 160 zone acre lots out there, so therefore we'll just lay that down on the map and make all of those parcels that are affected non-conforming. The idea is, if we do our job, then we'll make sure that we don't criminalize that process or make it burdensome. So the idea is, match this, our zoning, so that it's appropriate for the real world out there.
Councilor, this is Oliver, but I won't be reaching any conclusion. There's no way we will know, based on what is proposed, seeing the map, which ones are not legal.
I understand. But we know from our own history that those that are not legal in any time of our past, in any history, that those are the small percentages of the lots. They exist, they're out there, but they're not the rule. The vast majority of lots that have been created properly, but those are exceptions. I understand that. So the idea is that we would base our map on the rules, not the exceptions.
Yes, if I might, I want to get back and focus more on the alternative sizes. Those are legal lots, and I think our staff talked about that. The lots that were not legally created would not fall under what the intent of alternative four was, to make them legal. Because if they were legally created, then our intent is to make them conforming. And one of the things I wanted to ask, to see what you had in your pictures that you have up here, there's one form that we have out that actually shows the number of lots that are legal lots, mm-hmm, not conforming with homes on them. And then it actually shows the same thing, the same number that do not have homes on them. And if I recall right, it indicated about only an eighth of those that would qualify under alternative four. The others are already built on.
Yes.
Do you have that amongst the system?
Actually, these maps also are, they come from our GIS database, and each one of them is paired up or will be paired up with the Excel report that shows every single parcel that is the size of the parcel, the zoning that's overlaid on it, the designation, whether it be R, ag, or forest, and we can, and whether or not it's built, if there's a home on that property or a structure on that property, and all those numbers, I can tell you that we're still pulling out extra data, but each of these categories are in the thousands. They're not in the dozens. It's what's normal out there. Huge numbers. And that's the case for each of these designations, are ag and forest.
I guess the one that I'm trying to recollect, and it's kind of dangerous for me to throw a number out that I think, what I saw, it showed something like 632 that were legal, non-conforming lots with homes on them, and 130 of those without homes. I'm going by memory and what we saw, but the point I'm trying to make is that the impact is not as great as one might think. It's very, very small.
Mm-hmm. I think I had a request from a citizen for us to do the courtesy of introducing ourselves. So thank you for that, Val. So why don't we take a minute and go around the table?
I'm Aaron Erdman with the City of Battleground.
Jeff Knighton with the City of Ridgefield.
Ryan Snodgrass with the City of Vancouver.
Mitch Knipe, City of Washougal.
Zahn. Eric Eisman, City of La Center.
Robert Mall, City of Camas.
And Oliver Ojako with Clark County.
Christine Cook, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney.
Chris Horn, Prosecutor's Office.
Mark McCauley, Acting County Manager.
Jim Malinowski, I've been a member of Clark County Citizens United for 20 years.
Tom Milkey, Councilman.
Jeannie Stewart, Councilman.
And David Medora, Councilman. Councilwoman, you are.
Councilman.
Okay, generic term. Okay. The path going forward, Oliver, help us understand, the time is of the essence. We need to ensure that we go through, show our work, ensure that the community participates in this process, because we serve them. We're dealing with their properties, not our properties, and they need to be able to weigh in on these options. We need to be able to hear from them, and I understand there are two meetings scheduled soon, Ridgefield and Hawkinson High School. And if you could outline the path forward for us, that would be, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Council. Let me preface my comment with the fact that CEPA requires a variety of options. And if we add this, I think it will be within the CEPA rules. What we have planned for, if the board directs us to do so, is to take alternative 4 and alternative 3, which adds the new city request, and show that to the public. The first open house we schedule will be March 25th, 2015, at the Ridgefield High School from 5:30 to 7 p.m. The second one, open house, will be April 1st, 2015, at Hawkinson High School, the same time, 5:30 to 7 p.m. We also are looking at schedule a hearing with the board on April 14th. April 14, 2015. The purpose of that is to report back to the board of all the comments we received and other issues we would like the board to hear and take additional public comment, and then at that hearing direct us to restart the CEPA process. So that is the timeline that we have now. If you direct, if the council direct us to restart the SEPA process, of course you know I will come back in re-engaging our consultant. They may indicate that there will be additional cost,
yes,
which I will come back and ask the council to help us fund. So that's really the timeline and what I have in terms of next steps. There are other things that staff are working on and continue to coordinate with our cities. Hopefully we'll begin discussion with the council. I don't have that timeline with me, and hopefully we'll post that on our grid to show when we will start bringing draft policy language to the board and other things that we are supposed to do. For example, June 15 of this year is approaching, and by statute we are required to submit the buildable lands report to the state. I'm also coordinating with the cities to review that report when it's done, and I will check in with both the Planning Commission and the Council before that report is submitted to the state. So that work is underway, and starting the SEPA process is critical because that will then lead us to public commenting on that when the draft is out, and hopefully helping the Council to get us to what will be a preferred plan going forward, which will then kick off the final SEPA work, which will come back again for the board to use that document to make your final decision.
Sure.
So if you permit us today, we'll take this out to the public, these two open houses, and have them weigh in and see it. Not to belabor the issue, we're all seeing this morning, so I'd like to give the public the opportunity to see it and comment on it before we come back to the board in a hearing, and give others the opportunity who couldn't make it at the two open houses to further comment on it. My colleagues here are from the cities. Some of them will probably have to share this with their own council before or maybe come to the hearing, but I want to give everyone the opportunity to comment on it.
And I have a question for staff. So as I look at this map and some of the rezoning proposals that are in here, this strikes me that it's a fairly sweeping, what is commonly called in the GMA and zoning business, spot zoning. Does the county have a policy, or does GMA have restrictions on what are called spot zones, where you pick a certain parcel and rezone it? Have we, as a county, ever developed a policy on that, a planning policy, or are there legal restrictions?
Counselor, I don't think that appears in code, but that appears in common law through years of court decisions. So that's not something that the county, if it is spot zoning, it is not something that the county would be able to do regardless of county code.
Well, is my terminology wrong?
No, I think you're correct. You're talking about taking a relatively small property area in a larger area and changing its zoning.
If I can address that. Certainly spot zoning is not what's being proposed here. This.
I don't think it's the intent, but I'm wondering if it meets a legal definition for that. That's what I'm trying to sort out. And if there's a policy about that, I know in previous work that I've done, organizations had policies against spot zoning. But whether that was a local jurisdictional authority or whether that's under GMA or state law, I'm not aware.
It is not permitted under state law, and as these maps have appeared only within the last few hours, it's not something that we've been able to analyze yet.
But we would look at, you know, because we want to make sure that whatever we take out is meets all state law requirements.
That would be preferable, yes.
Well, otherwise people could look at it and say, yeah, it looks good to me, and then we can't implement it. That's just more frustration to people. So I just, moving forward, I just want to make sure that that's not challenged. So.
Sure, and if I could address that as well. What this shows is not the zoning for the area. It shows the exceptions, the incompatibility between our zoning and what's out there. And if we were to show the actual context with those, what we would see is the compatibility that would be more appropriate for if these lots were consistent with the adjacent areas. So these are the exceptions that pop out that reveals the spot zoning that in reality is there but is not recognized. This fixes that. If this, to the degree that it's called spot zoning. Spot zoning is certainly not legally defensible. It's not a direction we want to go down. And the definition of that has to do with singling out small or exceptional parcels and giving them a special status. And if you look at the map here, you see that those broad swaths of colors doesn't fit that definition, not at least not in the rule. There may be exceptions, and those exceptions can be handled. Chris?
Council, we're glad to meet with you, and we'll spend with you. The courts have made a distinction between when the board's acting in a quasi-judicial versus when they're acting in a legislative capacity. There are a number of issues that it's all raised. We'll be in discussion with the board about it. There is one issue, though, that will almost assuredly come up in connection with these meetings that are anticipated, and it would be helpful to have some direction from council. Councilor Madour, you made a comment that the rezoning is not intended to change the number of parcels or legal lots out there. Is the board's to the extent there are illegal parcels, can this is it the intent to allow the rezoning of these larger areas to...
Chris, if you can move your microphone...
Legal.
Go ahead and move your microphone closer and they can adjust the volume over there.
Sure. I'll restate my question. It's simply, your comment early on was that this is intended to recognize the parcels that are out there, not to create new lots. And my question is, because this almost certainly will come up to Oliver and to staff, to the extent there are illegal parcels in the rural or in the resource zone, will they continue after this comprehensive plan, if adopted by the board, continue to be illegal? Or will they be able to remedy that illegality based on the comp plan amendment?
I would say, first of all, the EIS process, and as we prepare more detail and presentation documents for these public meetings, and as we move forward with the analysis, more definition will be provided. But certainly I would think that the question is, how do we handle those exceptions? Those lots that were created illegally or incompatible with the area, yet if one potential solution as we look at this, the map, and as they pop them out, we can, I love the GIS database because we can pull those exceptions in. It would be to look at each individual lot as they pop out on the map and consider the context. If the adjacent areas are all within that same minimum lot size,
then I would think that they would be grandfathered in, and they would be, because they're compatible with the rural area, that rural local area. If they're not, then I would think that they would remain as illegal lots because they're simply not compatible on their face. But that is those kind of details would become apparent as we move through the process, because when we finally work all the way through this, there will be have to have a lot more detail than we have now. Right now we have guiding principles, goals, components, elements, and that's appropriate level of granularity at this point.
Chris, unless you want to add more, Council, if I hear you correct and if I understand your response, it doesn't imply that we can make the March 25th and April 1 open houses if we are going to refine what we take out there. So I still need direction from the Council, and from now until otherwise I will ask my staff to call the school and cancel the open houses.
We're not complicating anything. We're simplifying things, but I understand that the preparation of the documents that would be appropriate for these public meetings, in order for us to be able to better communicate with the citizens at a level that's not a work session here. There's plenty of opportunity, and I'm committed to continue to work with staff to ensure that all the full support is there in order to make sure that the time frame doesn't have to change, that there's plenty of definition that's available in a timely way.
Okay. I know that through SIPA, you wouldn't necessarily be making policy. You're going to wait until the analysis is done and get you to a preferred plan, and the staff will then be working with the public to articulate what that policy is.
Yes.
And then have you do have you approve that towards the end. I'm still at a loss.
We'll fill that loss in. Keep in mind that there are two levels here. The first one is to recognize the foundation. That's the first one. And the second one, the second step, is recognizing that foundation, building on that foundation, the other components that would look at the predominant lot size for each of these areas and determine what other lots belong in with that same flexibility and that same manageable zone. So those are two levels. One is recognize reality. The second one is to allow the flexibility of the adjacent predominant areas to be able to align with those same maps, so we don't end up with spot zoning.
Council, we certainly support going forward with the proposal to the public. We do feel a little abandoned up in our section of North County. Amboy doesn't get very much exposure. If there was a way to have a public meeting there, we'd certainly appreciate it.
Well, the time frame is really quite tight. And I would say that staff has really been very good to accommodate this alternative four we stopped the process, we inserted alternative four, and is really, Oliver, thank you very much for scheduling the meetings in advance so that the citizens can
a comment than a request.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Good morning, councilors. Robert Mall, City of Camas. Just something that Mr. Jaco mentioned a little bit ago is this is the first time that we've seen these maps, so we have to bring them to our respective councils for some comment and insight. I do have a couple of questions before I take it back to them. So with respect to the urban reserve and urban holding map, I understand that there's this limbo issue that you've discussed. But you're highlighting the urban holding areas holding areas that we have within our urban growth boundaries. They're showcased on this particular map. What are the intentions for those? Are those part of this limbo discussion? Because that does have some direct implications to our respective cities.
I think back of our First Amendment, where the citizens can address their government for redress of grievance. And I see George Espinosa out here and his neighbors. And we hear regularly from citizens that are in these zones that have been forgotten about, it seems. That's the way they feel. And in their eyes, their property values are reduced their ability to sell them is diminished, is difficult because they have an undetermined future. They don't know what their zoning is or what it's going to become, and they've been changed multiple times. So this, all this does is it brings forward to us the necessity to have a policy that says we need to make sure these have a reasonable time frame for review and for potential action. So it puts it's really a policy to-do list, an action item for the counselors here to properly use these tools and make sure we don't use them for a long-term moratorium, but virtual.
So it's not just the Discovery Corridor, it's all the city's urban holding areas.
I assume that if the kind of problem that's manifested in the Discovery Corridor is likely to be occurring in other areas. So certainly any of those areas that affect the cities, because those urban eventually the cities at some time in the future will likely inherit whatever has been developed and whatever infrastructure the county has invested in those areas, and it's important that we partner with the jurisdictions to ensure that they weigh in on this and they have a say-so as well. So it's not a thing where a county is going to define it without input from the jurisdictions. I think it's an important part of the process.
Okay. And then, thank you for that. And then for the other aspect that absorbed most of the discussion this morning, so assuming the county continues down this path of looking at these legal nonconforming and apparently a small amount of illegal lots out there, has there been analysis done to figure out if you correct the zoning out there, whatever that correction may look like, what kind of a potential lot count can that yield? I know that this analysis doesn't yield that, but the reality is that if you change the zoning out there, there will be a likelihood for further subdivision, further short plat, which then creates more densification in the rural area, which then affects potentially the rural residential split between the cities and the county that we'd agreed upon some time ago. You know, it would be nice to know if there's been some analysis on that, how many could it potentially yield in terms of almost a buildable lands report, if you will, for that rural component.
And keep in mind that all of the colors on the map so far do not add any new lots. It doesn't add any more flexibility to divide those lots any further. There is zero new building or lots available with all the colors that you've seen, not on this map, but the other maps. So that's the foundation. The intent, the elements that make up these guiding principles and the goals builds on that foundation. Right now we're blind because we've overlaid an unrealistic zone over most of the county, so we're blind. We don't know what is appropriate. But if we can start with I expect the implementation process will include working very closely with our own GIS, which is to create a layer that shows what would the zoning look like that would be consistent with reality, and then to allow us to be able to define what extra flexibility, what other areas would be, or what other lots in those same local areas belong consistent with those reality definitions. So that second step needs, those numbers will become apparent as they're defined through here, but we don't have that level of detail yet. It'll fall out of this process. And that's part of the EIS is considering how do you implement these corrections? How do you implement? How do you take a element and translate it to the map? And there's some discretion on that.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. And I recognize this is not a zoning map to create new lots, but again, in order to make changes to a map, there will have to be an implementation of zoning.
Yes.
And that likely will net in some increase in lots as
yes,
potential.
Yes, there will be, as you're right. And once we build on that foundation, there will be more flexibility, I expect, and there will be more manageable lots that will be compatible with what's already there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Eric Eisman, City of La Center. Jose, could you go to the La Center urban holding area? My comments, I don't want to repeat what Robert said, so I'll just second what he's already said and leave it at that. But I do want to comment about the urban holding in particular and the comment that was made about engaging the cities and getting the feedback from them. So if you look at the City of La Center and its urban reserve, and its urban holding areas. And if you were to, we tend to see it as a halo. It's where we can grow in the future and create jobs and housing opportunities. Some may see it as a noose, but we see it as a halo, an opportunity, particularly with the Discovery Corridor. But we also have some externalities that affect what we do out there, and that includes ag land, which this map doesn't reflect, and it also includes the new federal trust land that's on the opposite side of our junction right now. So those are externalities which do tend to hem us in. But I do want to raise the point, though, that when we start talking about what to do with the urban holding and the urban reserve, we do consider the future growth areas for the cities as well. And in particular, if you look at the area just south of La Center, in the 2000, and yes, thank you, Jose, in the 2007 comp plan update, there is a countywide plan policy that asks and requires the cities of La Center and Ridgefield to work collaboratively with Clark County to plan for that area between the two cities. And we certainly, both cities have signed an intergovernmental agreement back in 2008 or 9, wanting to do just that. So as we look at this urban holding, urban reserve, we need to pay attention to that agreement that's already in place, and we need to activate that. And the other comment then is that you've used the word reasonable. Mm-hmm. And as anyone who's worked in land use or law knows, reasonable means a lot of things to a lot of reasonable people. So I'd like to know mm-hmm. how you've defined that term so we have something we can start working with.
Well, you have two points you made there. First one has to do with ensuring that we remember there's some kind of there's that interlocal agreement that says, hey, county, don't forget about us. I would say that in addition, certainly the intention here and our track record has been to respect the not only just simply out of obligation because there's an agreement, but just simply because our role as we see it, and I think we're consistent with this, that we want to be good neighbors, and we're a team. All of us are responsible for stewarding the lands to make sure that the citizens are well served. And I think up to this point, we've been 100%. We're all on the same page, and we'll certainly continue that. In this case, where you have properties that are immediately adjacent to really the... the center is right there. I would think that's your future immediately.
Thank you.
And we need to recognize that. In the area, if you can bring up the Discovery Corridor area, that's way outside of Vancouver, and that some of these stretch way out. And, for instance... we had a letter read to us yesterday at a citizen comment time that indicated that Vancouver didn't ask for that. The county wanted that. And so I expect that who leads each area, I think it's important that we recognize who's going to be most affected and who's the most immediate... where's that leadership belong? But all of it belongs with collaboration. All of it belongs with making sure that we're brainstorming together and listen to the citizens and the various jurisdictions have an obligation to cooperate. So absolutely respect that.
So my takeaway from that would be that the policies as they unfold might be specific to different jurisdictions. Just as countywide plan policies now address Vancouver, address La Center, address Ridgefield, and so on.
I think we have both the policies that says we will have a reasonable time frame that says it comes up. It's not a long-term moratorium, but rather it's a periodic review process. You got that. On the other hand, you got practices that implement that policy that says, okay, it's time to be able to work with a particular area that's affecting La Center or Camas or wherever those are, and that partnership will unfold as a practice at that time.
And then as to the term reasonableness, what do we have something we can shoot at in terms of reasonable time frames?
You're right. And time frame, we are, I think we're all on the same page. It's timely. It's time sensitive. We need to be able to, in my eyes, it's non-negotiable. We need to hit the time frames. And the what is appropriate and what's reasonable and what's definition and what's criteria and how do we implement this process. At this point, we have the intents and the goals and the elements and how that works out in specifics. When we finally take these ingredients that we're baking the cake, when we get the EIS and we get those ingredients, then we need to nail down the real specifics of that and lock it in and say that's what those ingredients are, make up the cake. And there's definition that has to happen all along that process.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. I just echo the comments of my colleagues here. In terms of Washougal, the majority of the property identified on there is urban holding. It's within our urban growth boundary. Honestly, we look at our 20-year plan. That's the area that we look to grow, and the city of Washougal would then look at directing that path. There is a small portion of urban reserve in that area, which we had originally identified and asked for in 07, but were not given at that time. So I appreciate the idea and the notion that it may be different based on each jurisdiction, and appreciate the consideration for Washougal. I'd also like to mention, because last time I was here, I said that we weren't going to expand our urban growth boundary. The very next day, we had a very specific request from a property owner. I did share that with our council, and they were agreeable with that, and that's the 40-acre piece that was within the maximum study area, so there's no additional work needed from an environmental standpoint. It is residential. It does not need de-designation. We already have water to that site as well. Again, it's a request to come into our urban growth boundary. It's not an annexation request, and that will be some years out, most likely. Just a few comments, again, just kind of seeing the map again, but I made the comment last time I didn't really understand the direction of this recognition, and I had the privilege of working for the county for a number of years, and in that time, my specific job was doing legal lot reviews for building permits and independent law, requests. We always talked about that there was two paths that you had to have, two rails to a train track. You have to have platting and you have to have zoning. You have to satisfy both in order to have a legal lot. Every building permit that comes in has to give their deed history going back to 1969, unless they're in a recorded plat and we've identified that. This rezoning or recognition of lot sizes could quite possibly lead to properties that were maybe divided in compliance and now or not in compliance, and now you're going to recognize them. So there is that possibility. You also mentioned the notion that you're trying to make it easier by this in the zoning designation. And just for an example, if you had a 20-acre agricultural parcel and right next to it a 5-acre agricultural parcel, both zoned ag today, no building on it, and they came in to apply for a building permit, they would go through the same process today. They would submit that deed history. They do a legal lot review. Assuming that they were created in compliance with platting and zoning, they get a building permit. They're off and running. If you recognize now through this process that 5-acre as a 5-acre piece, so now it's conforming to zoning, still nothing on it, so you have your ag and your 5-acre piece, two different zonings, and they come in to apply for a building permit, they will go through the same process. Nothing will change there. It won't be easier for them because now all of a sudden they're ag 5, and it won't be harder for the ag 20 or you know, one way or the other. That process will be completely the same. And so I guess I just kind of to the point of still trying to figure out exactly what it is we're trying to get at with that. So thank you.
First of all, you made 2 points. The first one was, I think you said 40 acres to expand, to incorporate that extra expansion of the UGA, and that's already part of this. You've already submitted that?
That is in 3.1.
Great, great.
Appreciated the opportunity for that being opened up. Thank you.
And I believe that every request by each of the small cities have been accepted, and they are part of the EIS process. For instance, the 102 acres, was it, Oliver, from Ridgefield? Yeah, that's part of this process to be analyzed as well, correct?
The council have not made any decision on that, and I made that remark in my opening presentation. That's why I'm calling for a hearing on April 14th, for the council to make a formal decision directing staff to restart the CEPA process and which alternative should be in that review. If, as shown on alternative 3.1, that will be in your hearing package, and if after the hearing you direct that 3.1 be included, we have to modify the current alternative 3 and then ask our consultant to review alternative 3.1. You have not made any decision on all these requests.
If I understand correctly, today we need to be able to determine what moves forward with the public meetings and prepares for the EIS.
Yes.
And that's been submitted. Each of the small cities, whatever their requests have been, and at this point today, I would assume that the appropriate decision the decision that we need to be able to make so we don't hold things up is to give consensus, yes, all of these options that have been submitted ought to move forward to allow the public to participate and for the CEPA process to be restarted and expanded to include these options. I think we already get it that this is going to be extra work for the consultant. People get paid for the proportion of work, and I assume that that extra work costs money that we'll have to authorize that at that time.
Councillor, what we are asking for today is directive from the council that we take the alternative 1, 2, and 3.1 and what you presented today out to the two open houses, come back to a public hearing on April 14th. That's what direction we are seeking today.
That's how we move. That's how we make progress. That's how we move the ball down the field. And yes, so we understand the necessity for us to be able to be decisive today. Understand that. The second part of it has to do with how much easier does it get if the legal lot determination process on its face is compliant with the existing zoning or not. And at this point, hopefully, as we align our map to reflect the real conditions out there, we will be moving, at least we won't be complicating things. If anything, we'll be simplifying things, and I'm all for simplicity.
Well, and I guess the only thing that I'd say to that is that it is not a difficult task to, when you determine through the deed history when that parcel was created, the county, you've seen it here, we have excellent mapping and history, and we can go back and see what was the zoning at the time it was created, done. If it was in compliance, it's done. It doesn't matter what it's zoned today. And that's important to remember. It doesn't, if you've got an ag piece of property, 5 acres in ag, it doesn't matter what it's zoned today except for the use of it, and then you're looking from a legal lot determination, it doesn't matter. We'll go back to, in the past, in 1980, it was R5, therefore it's legal lot. They perceive that their building permit. It happens every day, probably, I don't know how many building permits you do, but a lot. Example, I guess, would be in this is that, and I don't know if the map is doing this, but is it recognizing those cluster lots? Is it recognizing those little small lots that are created through a cluster provision? And if it is, I mean, you have provisions now in a cluster that you're creating non-conforming lots. Every time you approve a cluster development, you are creating lots that are non-conforming. from a zoning standpoint. And if that's what you're trying to fix, then are we back here 8 years from now doing this update again, and we're going to get another map that starts recognizing all those little tiny ones, and then we're building off of that. Well, it's kind of close to that zoning, or it's that size, so it's kind of close. So I don't know, again, what this map does and seeks to, but it's important to know that through your process, you create non-conforming lots, and you have provisions for that, and that's a good thing.
And, well, thank you for that. And the exclusion of cluster lots is part of the intention here. We're not trying to fix cluster lots. The remainder lots that says those will not be developed, they will be preserved for the future. This does not touch that. So the idea here is to make sure that each of these individual lots and each of these lots that are not the exceptions but the rule out there are recognized. And that becomes the recognized rural character of each of these local areas.
Recognized in terms of zoning.
Yes, zoning. Anyone else?
Brian Snodgrass, City of Vancouver. Just a couple of brief comments. Just one, just wanted to confirm you have in the record our letter reconfirming our UGA position, which is not in support of expansions.
Oliver shaking his head, yes.
Within this update, that certainly everything we've seen in this process is indicating to us at least that there's ample land within the UGA to meet the growth targets. In terms of the maps and the essentially rural and urban reserve issues discussed today, I guess just one request and I don't know if this is possible at the open houses coming up, and in all likelihood our citizens probably won't attend, too many of them won't attend those, but certainly as we get to the EIS stage and then the publication of the DEIS, having a detailed knowledge of what zoning changes, if any, would be done in the urban reserve areas, I think will be pretty critical. So, you know, what is the impact? And I do understand the main intent is a policy change to give some direction to those folks, and then no objections there. But understanding what the zoning is going to be in this update for those areas, I think, is critical to responding to the EIS and the alternatives.
Yes, in that urban reserve and the urban holding, addressing those, there's nothing in here that proposes specific zone changes at all,
right?
Or even recognition, unless it's somehow just part of this the rural area. It is just simply a process that says, don't you misuse that short-term tool as a long-term moratorium. Bring it forward and bring definition to it. So that it somehow brings forward so it won't fall through the crack. People have been in those areas for years, and this is intended to remind us. The alarm clock goes off. It's time to review.
One other comment on the urban holding for the respective UGAs. I mean, there is no moratorium per se if those residents actually want to annex, to petition to annex, to come in with the city limits. I mean, that's an easy enough fix. So if their desire is to further develop their property, they approach the respective cities that they're located in terms of the urban growth boundary and try to work on an annexation solution. That's quickest and easiest way to do it, because then all the effort and monies that the cities had put into, and the county for that matter, for the comprehensive planning of those areas, capital facilities and everything, it's not gone to waste then if it's just this urban holdings lifted and that sure. They're allowed to develop in county context.
Sure, and when it comes to annexations, we look to each jurisdiction, each city, to be able to lead and implement that process as the city desires and work with their citizens that would be affected. Jose, if you could bring up the Discovery Corridor there, that area is so far out. This is from the city limits of Vancouver. Keep going north. Keep going north. Oh, okay, that is it. The city limits are down in the shaded areas, but the areas affected that we hear so much from the citizens are way far from that. So they really don't have a realistic option to be annexed into the city. They're wanting the city to back off and restore their flexibility. And I'm not saying that's the direction it'll go, but that's certainly the idea of the annexations where it's close in. Do you want that? I would say that a small city should lead, and Vancouver would lead. But when it's way out there, we need to deal with it in a way that doesn't leave them in limbo.
That's correct, Council. I think what you're going to be looking at here is, if you're talking about policy and timing, those are two different things, because the urban holding is used as a timing and phasing tool. You know, if you want to accelerate that timing, in this area, the burden is going to be on the county. I agree that this is not near the city. We are in a conversation and on what making 179 interchange improvement as a top priority.
Yes.
So, and you heard me say yesterday that the Clark Regional Wastewater is making a huge capital investment in this area. So we are going to be sending two signals to our partners depending on the final timing or acceleration that the council come up in terms of this area. We have been talking for many years about the number of county residents commuting across the river to work. Other previous county commissioners have made this area a top priority as a job producing land. If we are not going to have patient, you make a call as to how soon the urban holding comes off. But now it is a tool that we use for phasing development. If the infrastructure is out there, the urban holding will come off. If it's not there, you still use it. Remember, the urban holding is an area that is within the urban growth boundary and has urban zoning already on it. So we have to be mindful on accelerating. That's why I hear my colleagues asking, what do we mean by reasonable? Mm-hmm. You know, reasonable time frame, that's going to be your call.
And I understand that, if I understand correctly, I think it was been since 2007 that any decisions were made in that area. They've been in limbo that long. And it's not that we're running out of patients, but it appears that the citizens are running low on patients, because we were asking them, we haven't visited. The idea here is to come up with a plan, a master plan, so that the future at least has a horizon, reasonable expectations, and it just isn't something that's, well, it's, we're going to get to it someday. So the idea is to bring it into focus and give some hope and some clarification. The intent of the GMA is, as we grow responsibly, which means we build infrastructure and make the commitment and the plans for infrastructure. I'm pleased to see that this year, or late last year, the Fifth Plain Creek area that was in urban holding, or was that holding or reserve, for so long?
It was in urban holding, okay. In 07. That was when that area came into the urban growth boundary.
Yes, a master plan was created for that. It greatly improved what was originally proposed, and now those residences and those areas have a defined future that's hopeful, and they're not left stagnated. So I'm pleased to see that it is possible. The master plan process, if that's a high priority, hey, let's come up with a plan. That's really the idea of us to be able to make sure we pay attention to it.
Jeff Knighton with the City of Ridgefield. I was just concerned about the timelines, and I think we've already discussed that and had all those concerns aired, so that's the only comments that I wanted to make today.
Taken?
That's the only comments I wanted to make today, just on the timelines.
I have a question from a citizen here. Val, thank you very much. Will the dates on the open houses be changed? I believe that the plans right now are to, because of the time is of the essence, to stay with the schedule and to ensure that we move forward without holding things up. And that's really a decision today, whether or not that's we put this on track to... Or do we continue to hold? And so I would ask my fellow colleague here for direction.
What I'm concerned about is I've heard our chief planner indicate that he's concerned about the timetable and taking this out. Did I misunderstand?
No, my concern is that as if we are going to go out to the two open houses, my concern is that the alternative format as presented today will need further refinement. That's where I had some concern.
And so I see your concern, and I actually share your concern that because I've just seen it today, and I saw yesterday a sort of a tentative draft, but this more final presentation I'm seeing today. And so so I have some hesitation that we need to go through it carefully because staff didn't prepare this. So I think it's critical that our staff have time to look this over and to see if there are areas they're concerned about. But let me be clear in what my interest is here. 1994 GMA, the original GMA, 1994 update, 2007 update. The way that that was created and implemented, and each incrementally, has created some issues for our landowners in Clark County. The cities do a very good job of taking care of their internal boundaries, the zoning, the planning, and so on and so forth. But in the unincorporated areas, GMA has done some things that I think were unintended consequences to some of the property owners. And I do think that a plan update is a time to start looking at those in the big picture and seeing what can be corrected or what can be mitigated. Normally, how I would be interested is us doing it in the big picture through policies and maybe some rewrites, as opposed to me presenting or proposing this kind of detail. But the crux of it is that we need to get some momentum going under making appropriate changes. And people, that there are some properties that are in limbo. And it's true, some people have lived on them 40 years, and they maybe want to live on them until the end of their days. That's, we don't want them penalized. We don't want them to be told you have to subdivide because, you know, you're going to be taxed. Pretty soon the taxes are going to be so high. So we don't want to threaten or create discomfort for people who own parcels and just want to stay on them and be left alone. On the other hand, we have some families that are in transition, and they maybe own 100 or 40 acres, and they may want to divide that, and they may want to do some building and get some revenue back on that, maybe in some cases to help pay the taxes on it. So there are problems that exist in the unincorporated area more than there are inside city boundaries. And we do need to work on that. And can we do it all in this plan? Maybe not, but is it time to start dealing with that? And I think that is the important momentum that we have going on here, is that it's time to seriously address some of those issues and start working on getting those corrected. Will this alternative 4 be the answer to that? I don't know if this can be the answer, because I don't have enough of it under my belt. I've made a lot of good notes today. So with Mr. Milky gone, this is kind of awkward, because I might say I have a little bit of reservation if staff is going to have time to do a full analysis of alternative 4. to have that prepared for when that goes out on March 25th. And I can't be the, I can't gauge that. I need to listen to the opinion of our planning staff. So, Mr. Milkey sounded like he's ready to just go on this for March 25th and have staff be as ready, but he isn't here, so I say I have a reservation, but I respect what Mr. Medora is trying to accomplish.
And we'll address your comments. I want to make sure that anyone else at the table has an opportunity, if they want to be able to speak, that this is that time.
Erin Erdman with the City of Battleground. I just kind of want to reiterate every point that's been made by my colleagues so far, especially in relationship to what's a reasonable timeline. And then again, bring up a point that was made. I understand that this map is showing, you know, lots that are now non-conforming, but I don't really feel that that's such a big deal. And my other concern, as Mr. Mall brought up, is this map is showing the ones that are non-conforming, so recognizing the rural character that's out there now. But by doing that, how does that it could potentially affect the rural character, because now the conforming lots that are here have the potential to subdivide. And I think that's a good question to really fully understand the other side of it, is does that potentially change the rural character in the future, because how many new lots are we potentially creating?
Keep in mind that all the colors on those, none of those can subdivide. That's just simply recognizing what's already there. That's level one. Level two would be after we recognize those, and then those are showing the incompatibilities with what we've zoned versus what's there. When we overlay that with the rest of the zoning, and then we can see the compatibility with the predominant what's happening there that defines that rural character, is that next level. Would then that's the specific that says which one of those, if they were compatible with that, would be allowed to subdivide. And that's the level that also needs more definition to bring forward, but we can't get there without going here first.
And I think just to that's a concern of ours. So.
It's a concern for all of us, but it may not seem like a big concern for you, but as a elected representative, I hear from citizens it's a big deal for them. Thousands of citizens, it's a big deal. This is really important. And this has been many of the citizens have been stinging since 1994. And the comp plan update since then, and we don't want to kick the can down the road. It's time for us to be able to catch things up, fix what needs to be fixed, and to make sure that the rural citizens' interests are represented and their future is addressed. Anyone else?
I certainly urge you to go forward with the alternative four. It's not perfect from our perspective, but if you don't go forward with alternative four, then basically all you have is three status quo alternatives. And I think you'll see in the public meetings what input people have about what's proposed in alternative four and changes in alternative four they'd like to have. So if you don't go forward with it, then you have eliminated anything but the status quo.
And I don't think that the question is whether or not we're going to have staff do an analysis of alternative four. It's will that analysis be done in time for the March 25th hearing? So that's...
I think rather than the there's really maybe analysis isn't quite the right word, because the analysis is part of the EIS process and the presentation of those options between now and then. We just got to make sure that we provide the what is it that's being proposed, what are the options that are being proposed, and get and allow the citizens, the landowners, to be able to weigh in on that process. Yes, there needs to be much more definition and documents created. It's my responsibility to support staff to the degree necessary in order to make sure that they're not left hanging with something that's not clearly enough provided. So to the degree that, first of all, let me back up. GIS and Oliver's department, planning department, has been very, very supportive outstanding, flexible. They work really hard, and it's, I think it's our responsibility to make sure that they're supported with everything they need in order to move forward. I'm committed to work as hard as necessary in order to make sure that there's nothing left undone for staff to know that they have enough to present.
And I used the wrong word. I don't mean a complete analysis. I mean that staff would do a complete review of the proposal of alternative four. Yes, so I used the wrong terminology. The full analysis will be at a different time.
Okay, and we'd like to thank you. You stated our case very well, the concerns we have.
Yes.
Anyone else? Okay. With that, do we have a consensus at least to move forward with the public process on this?
Well, I'm going to say yes, move forward with the public process, but I'm going to say that staff needs time to do a review of alternative four. I got this last revision this morning, and if staff has had their last revision, it was either yesterday or today.
This morning.
And this morning? Well, so absolutely they need time to do a complete review of this final proposal here, because we've seen alternative four in several versions in the past, but this is the current one that's on board. Planning staff needs time to do a complete review of that, and so that can be done by March 25th to meet that meeting date. I don't know.
If I can make one point, and that is that the alternative for presentation, as you seen on the PowerPoint here, was provided to staff first thing Monday morning. So it's been posted on the grid since then as well. What has been presented in addition to that, which was new this morning, it was the map that we looked at, these two maps. There are other maps yet to follow because it is a lot of work. There's a lot of work here to do. And GIS, the resources in GIS, the database that's there, is a powerful tool that must necessarily follow these goals and these elements. These elements unfold in maps. So the maps is something, the generation of that in preparation for what's to follow is kind of the preparation for the documents to be presented. Anything else?
No.
Okay. So we have a consensus to move forward with options, all the options?
With the provision that staff has adequate time to give this a complete review so that they will have time to be prepared for the March 25th.
So, Oliver, that's your call.
But what is, I heard more maps are going to be coming. And so are those included as part of alternative four?
Yes.
That's my, I'll speak up because my mic's not on. That's my concern by way of clarification is just, is the map that's reflected in alternative, are the maps that are reflected in alternative four going to remain stable so that it is the document that staff will be presenting to the public so that there's some consistency? Otherwise, you're not going to know until you get the last one, which is the one. And we're going to be publishing these to the neighboring, first of all, the public's already seen it today. So if there are, if there are enhancements, but the substance of the maps is going to remain the same, I think that's one thing. But if the maps are actually going to change on any particular parcels, it makes it very difficult to do any review or answer any questions from the public because we're not going to be showing them the final version.
I guess what it really comes down to is this is fixed, and the maps that are created by this need to be able to be fixed, no longer a moving target, by some time, by some date. And the question is, what date do we have to be able to ensure that the additional maps that support this are, when do you need them? When's the drop dead? When does the teacher say, time's up, turn in your pencils, turn in your tests?
15 days.
Counselor, I will need it by the 12th. Doesn't give us much time, but to meet...
That's tomorrow.
Yes, that's tomorrow. And I thought this was going to be the final. Why is tomorrow significant? We have to meet our own deadline to allow the reflector to publish it so the public know. So you're looking at, it's not a hearing, but it's not illegal. We're going to treat it as a public notice that the county is holding a work session these two dates. And to meet that obligation, we have to send something to the newspapers by tomorrow, no later than the next. So if I were to go downstairs now to prepare a legal or public notice that the reflector will publish, they will tell me they need it tomorrow.
Well, certainly I don't expect that all of the... There are multiple maps involved, both for alternative 3 and 4, and I expect that we don't publish those maps in the newspaper. Rather, we publish all of these kinds of documents. In this case, each of the work session-related documents get published on the grid, and the public notices that would go to the newspaper to the degree that says what the purpose of the meeting is, what the content of the meeting is, that certainly needs plenty of notice. Chris?
I will let our counsel jump in because I was talking about legal notice. The same goes for the public to see the document,
mm-hmm.
and there is a time frame for them to see it. It also is 15 days prior to the meeting. So the public has the same timeline. The document and the notice are all consistent. The public need to see what is it that we are going to be presenting 15 days prior to the day that we are going to be having the meeting.
So I would agree that the public should have access to the proposal, and if the proposal includes maps, then the map should be something that the public can get to. If we publish a notice and says, to see this proposal, click on such, which is typically what is in our public notice, and somebody clicks on that link, and nothing is there, or an inaccurate version is there, that is potentially a problem.
Jose, could you bring up the grid, please? And I share those concerns as well. We need stability. We need to be able to have visibility. We need to be able to have clear communication with the citizens to know what is being proposed out there. If you look at the entry there here for March 11, we have the alternative 4. When we click on that, that up comes the presentation that has been stable and fixed and no changes. The idea is as maps become additional maps to help to support this and join with those documents, that we can enhance that. We can add extra clarity and extra detail as we approach that meeting. And so certainly the idea is not to change the target, not to move the target, not to change the definition, but to still allow us to be able to provide as much clarity and as much visibility, and if there's additional documents that to turn on the lights, provide that between now and then, I would think that would be helpful at least for several days from now. I'm thinking tomorrow we got the state of the county and there is a preparation to do that. And so I'm looking for opportunities to, as we approach those meetings, to be able to add more clarity.
Commissioner or Councillor, my only question, if all the maps are intending to do is clarify or enhance certain
yes.
points, then I don't anticipate there being a legal issue. If particular parcels will change as a result of this mapping, or the zoning on particular parcels will change, those are substantive changes. So if all you're talking about is blowing up maps, different views of maps, color coding maps, any of the things that don't change the substance of the maps, I don't anticipate that presenting any legal problem for the council. My only concern is if you're going to be changing the zoning for particular sections or particular parcels, that is a substantive difference and does present a problem for us. So I'm just trying to, again, I just want to tie down what staff is obligated to analyze and what we're going to be preparing for the public hearings when it's going to be finalized. And if what you're telling us today is that what's in on the maps in terms of the land that's being analyzed and the parcels that are being subject to review are the parcels that are in existence right now or at least displayed, I think we're done. The only question is that the final mapping that the board anticipates?
Well, certainly we need, at this stage in the game, I think we need to be able to have the EIS and the goals and the principles and how the specifics unfold in the EIS needs to be able to have the play that out in a way that is consistent with those. In other words, the plan is outlined very clearly as to what those elements are, and how that affects every parcel on the map is something that, as the EIS gets unfolded and as we get public comment, that the hopefully we'll be able to not only we'll be able to respond to the public. And not have it a foregone decision. This is it, and this is only it, and we're not going to change it. We need to be able to make sure that we're not going through these public meetings on an academic exercise, but that we are, and I expect it, we're continuing to hear from citizens day by day here to make sure that if they're asking for extra clarity, if they're asking for the options of how these can be played out, that they at least those options will be some of those options will be available. There'll be more options as time goes by, hopefully. But the idea is stability, without somehow locking it in and say, okay, you can't provide any more clarity. Okay. Okay. Anyone else?
So if staff in their review of alternative 4 identifies something in there that would require that is an issue that is substantive, they will communicate with legal staff and let you know that, correct?
Yes, very important part of that. Is there anything else? Okay. Are we done? Okay. I think we're finished. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well.